In this lecture, we're going to go over generative models in the first part, and then in the second part, we're going to see how recurrent neural networks, or RNN, work in practice. So in the previous lecture, we have seen how a generative model works. So the main purpose of a generative model is to take some data, or some training data, and to output some new data. So this could be either images, like symphonies, any type of training data. And then what we aim to get out here is some new data that could be useful to real applications. So maybe we want to get some new pictures or new spin configurations, depending on the application we want. Okay. So in order to be able to achieve this task of having some new data that follows the same probability of the data, we need some model that has some parameters theta. So those are the parameters of the generative model, and we want this probability to be as close as possible to the probability of the data, okay? So remember that this is something we don't know in practice. But so one way to do that is to maximize the likelihood of the data given the parameters, okay? So this is what we've seen in the previous lecture. And we've seen that in practice, doing this is not it is not practical because of the fact that we have a product of many probabilities that come because of the number of data points in the data set. So for that, we have seen that we can minimize the negative log likelihood, which is equivalent, or called also NLL, which is equivalent to minimizing the KL divergence between the probability of the data and the probability of the model. Okay? Sounds good so far? Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. Do we have any guess for p theta that have some parameter?
You mean ansatz? That's a very good point. So that's exactly the point of using neural networks over here. So the idea is we want to have some ansatz that's general enough that we can describe some complicated data. Of course, if we, let's say in physics, when we have, for instance, want to target some ground state, we have some idea about what the ground state should be. So it will be a good idea to have a well-informed ansatz or a model.
It depends on the problem. So quantum can be Gaussian or...
Yeah, so if we know that the data is Gaussian, it's a good idea to use a Gaussian instead of a neural network. So if we have an idea, that would be a good idea to use a well-informed ansatz, but if we have no clue about what the data look like, it might be useful to use a more like a general enough ansatz or a model here. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, go ahead.
If I remember correctly, to use this maximum likelihood principle, we had to assume a uniform prior.
Yes. Yeah, so that's a very good point. So let me just again remind you what we've done. So we used the Bayes rule. So we wanted first to maximize the posterior, so that's the probability of the parameters given the data. And using Bayes' rule, that's the probability, that's the likelihood, times that's the assumption, the prior, over the probability of the data. Okay, so this is constant. Those terms depend on the parameters theta, okay? So we said that if this is constant, then maximizing this is the same as maximizing this, okay? Of course, here we have like a uniform prior. Of course, we can choose another assumption. So one assumption we can make is that, for instance, these parameters are, for instance, Gaussian, that they actually follow some Gaussian distribution. So this first assumption will be updated and will result in some new parameters over here. So if, like, for instance, if we assume some Gaussian distribution, you'll see like there is a result that says that if you assume a Gaussian in a prior, it's the same as imposing L2 regularization. Okay, so. So the techniques that you've seen in the homework can be mapped to some probabilistic interpretation of the prior. But if we just assume that this is uniform, then it's maximizing the likelihood is the same as maximizing the posterior over here. Okay, does that answer your question?
I guess I also have another question. Is it ever assumed that you use the prior distribution that sort of use the max end principle? Maximize your entropy or your ignorance over everything? Is that
yeah. Yeah, so if we use like the maximum entropy principle, then that will correspond exactly to a uniform distribution. So for instance, you want to have to explore the parameters as much as you want in the beginning, and then you want to target some specific parameters at the end. That could be a useful principle. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, does that answer question? Okay, cool. So now after the second part of the lecture, we've seen some types of generative models. We've seen some models where this likelihood p theta given the parameters are this p theta. So I mean here the same thing, it's just different parameterization. So those are the models where this p theta can be computed exactly. So we have seen that types of these. So we have seen the autoregressive models. So an RNN or recurrent neural network is a type of these autoregressive models. We're going to see them in detail. We have seen also flow-based models where we transform, we do a change of variables to transform from simple probability distribution to some more complicated probability distribution. And we also seen like an example of approximate likelihood models. So those are the models where this cannot be computed exactly with an efficient scheme. So the computation of these probabilities could be exponential within these models. So this is what we have seen with the restricted Boltzmann machine, where we've seen that the partition function is intractable to compute, especially if we have a lot of, let's say, for instance, if you're dealing with spin configurations, the sum will grow exponentially with the system size. Okay? But we've seen that it's possible to do sampling, because if you remember from previously, I've told you that if you want to sample the probability of the RBM, you just need to do the ratios of spin configurations with, if you remember with this, with the Metropolis sampling scheme, if you want to like do some updates, what you need to do is just to do compute the ratio. If you compute the ratio, we don't need actually the partition function. So that's what makes the use of these possible, even if we don't know the value of this exactly. Okay? And now in this lecture, we're going to see, I'm going to give you a brief introduction about to autoencoders, and then to other models called like implicit likelihood models. So this is where we don't know exactly what the expression of the likelihood, but we know that during the training process, we kind of this probability arrive is closer to the probability of the data. Okay, so these are called the, so an example of these is the generative adversarial networks, or also called GANs. And then in the last part of the lecture, I'm going to show you a little bit about RNN architecture. And then I'm going to show, if time permits, I'm going to show you like a limitation of these architectures and how we can overcome these limitations. And then last part, I'm going to give you a discussion about how these architectures can be used for quantum physics. This was an example of what I was doing in research in my PSI essay when I was doing PSI. Okay. So do you have any questions so far? Is everything good? Okay, cool. So let's get started. So let's get started with autoencoders. Yes.
Minimizing the negative log likelihood, we are happy with huge probabilities or numbers essentially. We have like factorization. We said this because.
Yeah. So yeah. Exactly. So you're asking like that. The issue here was that we have a very small number. That's why we use that. Is that your question?
Yeah, and I mean that will be huge if we're okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So if, for instance, this number is 10 to the minus 100 or 1,000, then within the log, it will give us some reasonable number that can be optimized. Okay? Does that answer your question? Yeah. So with respect to the autoencoder, so it has a very special architecture. Let me draw it for you. So it's made of a first part. So that's called the encoder. So it takes some input x, and then it outputs some hidden variable, or also called latent variable, z, okay? And then this latent variable z is serve as an input to what's called a decoder. And this results in a new output. We call it x hat. Okay? And the goal is that we want, what we do is we take the input and then we squeeze it, or we try to compress it into a small variable. So if this the size of this is, let's say, 1,000, then we try to compress it to, say, like size 10 or smaller than that. Okay? So we try only to take the important components in the x, and then using this z, or this latent variable, we try to reconstruct x to get the x hat. Okay? And the way we do that is by using the loss function that looks as follows. So the loss function, for instance, let's say if you only have one data point, just for simplicity, that would be the distance between x hat and x over here. Okay? So the encoder and the decoder can be neural networks. You can choose like a CNN feedforward neural network with the encoder and a different architecture for the decoder. Okay? Sounds good? And there, after the training, what we can do, so once we know that this architecture managed that the x hat is close to the x, what we can do after is that we can drop the encoder. So after training, so we take only the decoder. Then we can choose new values of z, and then we can choose some new values of z, and then we can output some new data, okay? So for instance, we can give some z prime, and then we can get some x primes over here, okay? You see the idea? First, we train this architecture so that we can first squeeze the data to a small size, and then we train a decoder to convert this squeezed variable to a reconstructed input using this loss function. And then after the training, we input some new values of z to output new data points. OK? Sounds good? So just so you remember, so here, this architecture allows to compress the data. So only allows to retain the important components of the data. OK? This is the main purpose of this architecture. Yes, go ahead.
Using a regular autoencoder to generate new data in this way, how do you choose new z's?
That's a very good point. So here, so this scheme is deterministic. So in the autoencoders, so you're choosing like this going from here to here is deterministic. But like if we want to have a probabilistic interpretation, so that's another variation of the autoencoder. So that's called the variational autoencoders. I'm not going to cover that, but if you want, we can discuss that after the lecture. But like, I just want to mention this generative model because this is the simplest one that we can find. And then, for the probabilistic interpretation, maybe we can have a discussion later. I just wanted to show you that this is something that exists in the literature. So for the probabilistic interpretation in terms of the likelihood, as you've seen there, that does not look obvious from here. But if you want, if you're interested, we can discuss that later. Okay? Just wanted to keep the discussion short here. Yes, so now after seeing the autoencoders, let's see how the generative adversarial networks work. Okay, so again, for the GANs or these architectures, I'm going to keep the discussion simple as well.
And just did you mention how the compression works, like whether this is also dimensional reduction?
Yeah, so the size of this variable is a hyperparameter. So the smaller it is, the more blurry this picture will look like. So if you have picture, like let's say MNIST, like a picture of one, and then you compress it and then you decompress it, that one here will look a little bit fuzzy depending on the size of this.
So, in terms of the method used, I'm not sure whether you commented or not.
Oh, you mean, like, can you say that again?
Like the methods used to do the data compression?
Oh,
I'm not sure whether you made a link to, you know, the techniques we saw. Like,
So you're asking if, like, if this compression is related to, like, maybe another method you've seen, like a PCA or something like that? So it's a bit unrelated to that. So what you can do, for instance, is just take a neural network. Let's say a feed-forward neural network. So if the size here is 4, you can just compress it to a size 2. That's the thing I mean here by compression. You just, like, make the size of the input smaller at the end. Okay. Does that clarify what mean of compression? Okay. There's no other question. Let's do the generative adversarial network. So let me do generative adversarial networks. So those are the models where we don't know what's the likelihood exactly. But the knowledge of the likelihood is implicit. Let me clarify what this means. So this means, so we just want to sample data. And we don't want to have knowledge to compute the likelihood. Okay. So the way these architectures work is as follows. So first we have what's called a generator. So here we input some variable, it's called z, and then at the end we get some variable, another vector called, let me call x fake, and then I'm going to explain what this means after. And then we have a discriminator, let me call it d. So here this discriminator takes either this x fake or takes x real. Let me explain what this means after. And then here at the end we get an output y that could be either 1 or 0. 1 stands for real, 0 stands for fake. Okay. So let me explain what this means. So here the goal of GAN is to do a competition between a generator and a discriminator. Okay, so what the generator does is that it takes some random variable z, okay, and then at the output we get some fake data. So the fake data is different from the real data. So the real data is some data set we have, let's say pictures, and here the generator tries to generate some fake data, okay, and then the goal of the discriminator is to tell whether this picture or this vector is fake or whether this one is real, okay? So it's a competition. So this generator tries to fool the discriminator, but the discriminator tries to see whether this was fake. The input was either real or fake. Okay, so let me write that. So the goal of the generator is to generate fake data points similar to the real data points. And then the goal of the discriminator D is to generate or to distinguish X fake from X real. Okay. Okay, so what's gonna happen is that as the disk commutator learns more how fake can tell the fake from the real, the generator will try to make the fake data looks like the real data. So at the end, what's gonna happen is that the fake data will look like the real data, and then at the end, we can just use a generator to generate some new data. Okay, so let me explain this how this looks like intuitively. So initially, so let me show you an intuition of this, maybe over here. Okay, so here, let me show you an intuition. So let's say we have a line here where the fake data are these orange dots, okay? So those are fake points. Let me draw another line where the real data are these crosses over here. Okay? So these will be the fake data. Okay? So those are, let's say, the points that were generated by the generator over there. And those are the real data points we have in our data set. So what the discriminator does is that it assigns a very high probability to these data points and a very low probability to these ones in order to say that those are real, those are fake. Okay? Let's imagine that we have a very high probability over here, very low over here. Okay? So that's, let's say, the first training step in these architectures. And the second step, so that's step one. Step two is that the generator now tries to make the fake data points closer to these, to the real data points. So it's going to try to make them closer and closer. And then here will be manifested as the font. So you're going to see here that these points will get closer and closer. And now the discriminator will need to do harder work to distinguish between the real data and the fake data. Okay, so now we're going to have a more peaked probability. Okay, and then after some steps, maybe at the end, the fake data will look like the real data. Okay, so now when it comes to the generator, the discriminator, it will have a hard time to distinguish between the fake data and the real data. Okay, and this is what happens at the end. So at the end, the discriminator does not manage to distinguish between the fake and the real data, and this is the time where we can use the generator to generate some new data. Okay, so at step three, so and at the end. We can use the generator, so we can input some new z primes to the generator. And then at the end, we can get some new data points, even if they're already meant to be fake, they will look real after at the end of the training process. Okay? So I just wanted to go over the high-level details over here. I not mentioned the mathematics. I just wanted to give you an intuition so that you can get started if you want to read the literature. Okay. Yes, there's a question. Okay.
What is the input that the generator is getting to understand whether it's, how does it make things go closer to the real data or something like that? There should be some feedback or something.
Yes, so that it should be a loss function. So the loss function, I'm not defining the loss function over here. So So I just want it to, because it looks a bit complicated. So I don't want it to make the explanation like difficult. But there is a loss function that allows to give a feedback to the parameters of the generator so that it brings the parameter closer to the real data. Okay.
Is that, without going into detail, but does that loss function take as input the real data, or does it take as input the output of the discriminator?
Well, it takes both, actually. So it takes both the discriminator and the generator. So it's actually it's actually like a minimization and a maximization at the same time. I don't want it to go into the details for that, but it's kind of a game. So it's a game between a discriminator and a generator, and it's shown that it will, and it can end up in an equilibrium like that.
I meant the function for training the generator specifically.
So I don't have that on top of my head, but if you want, I can. In the after the lecture, we can discuss the details. Sounds good. Okay. Is there any other question before going to RNNs? Yes. Yeah.
What is the distribution?
Oh, okay. So yeah. So this is like a distribution that the discriminator assigns to each data point. So for instance, this point has a very high probability of being real. And this one has a very low probability of being real. So it will say this is fake. Yeah, sorry, I didn't clarify that. So at the end, like if we want to distinguish those points, it will be hard to draw a probability like that.
So you're
saying
the second step, it has to learn.
Yeah, it will be sure. Yeah. So that's an intuition. I'm not saying this is what happens in real life. I just wanted to explain what happens like at the high level.
Yeah,
okay. Sounds good? So now let's go to RNNs. I hope half an hour will be good. Okay. So maybe what I can get started with is some motivation for RNNs. So maybe I can share with you my screen.
Is that a mathematical reason? The third one is harder to learn because, like, intuitively, you know, it makes sense to me to say that learning something sharp is harder, but.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. It doesn't have to be that way, but, like.
So. Your question is, like, what does it have
to. Why exactly is it hard for this network to learn something that isn't so sharp?
Oh, like that?
Physical system where you might say you have like a resolution that needs to be really precise in order for me to distinguish two things. Like,
I see what you mean. Yeah. So what I wanted to mean by this example is not exactly what happens in real life. I just wanted to give you at least like an intuition of what happens in the training process. Of course, like the details of how a discriminator and a generator can be distinguished from each other, or the real data from fake data. How can they be distinguished? That's a different question. But I just wanted to show you by the analogy of points being closer to each other that it's hard to distinguish at the end. But like, I don't want you to go into the details because this is not what I wanted to mean. Yeah. But does that answer? So the first motivation I wanted to start with is the following. So just wanted to show you an application of what RNNs can do. So the first application I want to show you is the following. So there was a symphony by Schubert called the Unfinished Symphony. So if I remember, like the story is that Schubert had a symphony and at some point he didn't finish it. So this was called the Unfinished Symphony. And what this company does is that they use a recurrent neural network to be able to complete the symphony. Okay, and I want to show you a sample of the finished symphony, of the unfinished symphony. Okay, so let me play a sample for you. it looks very, yeah, it looks very coherent from what you see. So I just wanted to show you that there is the potential of these architectures to handle these sequential dependencies in music. Okay? Yes? Go ahead.
Does it regenerate? Like, can you play it again and it'll generate something slightly different to the...
So that I don't know, like, how the details of that. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think they might have run into issues like that, but they have to, like, call, like, a technician or, like, some expert in music so that they can fill in the gaps or something like that. Yeah, but I think, yeah, so already, like, just managing to have something coherent like that is already great. Yeah. And also another application I want to show you is that they can be also used for, like, in addition for applications in machine translation and speech recognition, they can be also used for climate, like, forecasting. So they can be used for predictions of, like, what's the weather for the next few days or so. And also at the end of the lecture, hopefully if we have time, I want to show you applications of these architectures in quantum many-body physics. Okay? So that's the plan. So first, I'm going to briefly talk to you about the architecture. And then if we have time, we're going to talk about the vanishing and exploding gradient problem. And then I'm going to show you some results of what I had in my BSI essay on the relationship between RNNs and quantum physics. Okay? So let's get started. As we have seen, these architectures, originally they are used for language processing. So let me write that. Originally, for language processing. And it has a lot of applications, as we have seen. So for main applications of these were originally for tasks related to machine translation. Speech recognition. And then, as you have seen in the example I played for you, it can be also used for music generation, maybe for other sequential tasks like DNA, sequential analysis, then we're going to see at the end that D can be also applied for applications in quantum physics, okay? So that's the main purpose of these. And then the key idea is that we're going to use the probability chain rule, as we've seen in the previous lecture. So remember the probability chain rule. Let's say just to simplify the discussion, instead of working with a text or music notes, let's just work with spin configurations, okay? Let's imagine that we have a spin configuration sigma made of spins, sigma 1, sigma 2, until sigma n, or each of these can be either plus or minus 1, okay? And then what we can do is we can factorize the probability of this spin configuration into a product of conditionals, as we've seen for autoregressive models in general. We have P of sigma 1 times the conditional probability of sigma 2 given sigma 1 dot, 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 until sigma n given all the previous spins. All right? Okay. And you can imagine that if we can have, so the idea here is to use some parameterized model to approximate these conditional probabilities. Okay? That can we can use, for instance, with the negative log likelihood that we can minimize during the process in order to have this probability to match the probability of the data. Okay? If you want to use it for generative modeling. Now let's see how we can compute each of these conditionals using RNNs. Is it good if I erase here? So with the RNN, we can imagine that we have some black box or some neural network. So let me just draw this box over here that has some neurons. And then that takes initially some vector. Let me call it H0. Okay, so that's initially we can have a null vector. So it means that this vector is filled with zeros initially. I'll tell you after why. Then we can also imagine having an input, a null input. Zero, zero. We're going to see why it has this form. And then what we do after is we predict this first term over here. So that's the probability of sigma 1. Okay, so at the output here, we compute the theta of sigma 1. That should be two-dimensional, okay? Since here the case, so for each spin we have two values, plus or minus one. So we want to output a two-dimensional probability. So for the first one, would be the probability of having a spin down. So let me call it p down, and this is p up, okay? And then what we do is we sample sigma 1. Okay, so I mean by sampling, we just take a coin according to this probability distribution, you flip it, and you get either up or down. That will be the value of sigma 1. Okay, is this step clear? Okay, and then after that, at the output of this neural network that I'm going to define after in a second, so we get a new vector H1 that's computed using these initial vectors in the parameters of this neural network. And then here, you're going to use the same neural network. Let me draw the same picture. We're going to use the same neural network over here. And that's the reason why it's called the recurrence, because we keep reusing the same architecture again and again and again. Okay? So here, what we feed in is the value we got for the sample here. So we got sigma 1, which could be either, let's say, 0, 1, so 0 for down, or 1 for up. So here, as an input, we take the 1 hot encoding of this. Okay, so we either feed in 1, 0, that would stand for spin down, for instance. Or if the spin we got, so this is for sigma 1 down. And if sigma 1 was up after the sampling, we'll have 1, 0, or 0, 1. OK? So either one of these will be fed to the neural network again. And then at the output, since we have now information about the previous spin fed to the same architecture, we expect to get a conditional probability here, OK? Probability of sigma 2 given sigma 1. Okay, so that will be p theta of sigma 2 given sigma 1. Again, it will be a two-dimensional probability. Let me call it p prime down, p prime up. And then we do the same thing. We sample sigma 2. Again, we get some new vector H2 over here. Use the same architecture. We feed the one hot encoding. Let me call it sigma 2 vector. Okay, And then at the end, we're going to get a new vector, p theta of sigma 3, given sigma 2 and sigma 1. And then we can, after sample sigma 3, and so on and so forth. OK? So just wanted to note as well is that this vector h2 has information about sigma 1 as well, OK? So it gathers information about the past. And that's the reason why we also have a dependence on sigma 1 as well. So we, here we only fed sigma 2, but since h2 has information about sigma 1, we also have the these conditional dependencies. Okay?
Are we feeding
yes?
data at any point?
Can you say, yeah, can.
Are we feeding in any data? Where
so that's the point. So here we don't have any data, so we're just generating some spin configurations. So we only feed spin configurations, but if we have data, I can show you later how we can do that. Okay? So this is just generating some new data, like out of some either untrained or trained recurrent neural network. Okay? So as I've told you, we keep generating these sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3 until we arrive at the last spin, let's call it sigma n. And then the so that will be generated out of p theta sigma n given the previous spins. So the probability, so the joint probability of all the spins will be the product of each of these probabilities. Okay. So using the probability chain rule. Okay. Is yes? Go ahead.
I would think that for sigma 1, the probability would be 1/2 and 1/2.
Yeah, so that's.
Can
yeah.
you like, ensure that that's what's happening?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. So, yeah. If I clarify after like what's inside this black box, once we clarify that, it will be clear that we can do this. We can have 0.5 here, 0.5 here at the beginning if you want. But in some applications, it might be that we don't want that in the beginning. We want, for instance, 1, 0 over here in the beginning. So it depends on the type of the application you want. For instance, if we have some like system where we have some flip symmetry, like a Z2 symmetry, it might be useful to have 0.5, 0.5. If you have another system that we might need to change those values. That's a good question, yeah. Is there any other question? Well, now let me show you what's inside this black box here. So the question is how to define, let me find here, how to define this black box here, okay? So let me draw the picture again for you. So we have our architecture that takes some previous vector, hn-1. So this is at some step n. We feed in the 1/2 encoding of the previous spin, so we feed in sigma n-1. Then at the output, we get a new vector hn. And then here, we get the probability, let me call it a vector yn, which contains the probability of either having a spin down or a spin up. Okay. So in real life, like in reality, what this looks like is the following. So we have what's called an RNN cell that takes this vector hn-1. And then outputs this new vector hn. It also takes as an input sigma n-1. And then this new vector hn is copied and fed into what's called a softmax layer. I'm going to define what these layers, or in this cell, looks like in a second, in equations. And then at the output of this softmax, we get a new vector, this vector yn. Okay? Sounds good? So let me define now how this new vector hn, which is a function of this sigma and h, look like in the RNN. So h of n is a function of h of n minus 1 and sigma n minus 1. Okay? And in reality, it looks as follows. So for the simplest RNN we can define is what's called the vanilla RNN. So for a vanilla RNN cell, we have some nonlinear activation function f. And then what we do is we take our vector h of n minus 1. We take our previous spin sigma n minus 1. We multiply this with some weight matrix. Let me do it with a color. We multiply the sigma with some other weight matrix v. And then we add some bias p, and then we also add these three contributions. Okay? That's the simplest formula we can have. So as you can see here, at each step we add some information about the previous spins to the new h. Okay? It makes sense to call this vector a memory state. It's also called, you can also find in literature that it's also called as the hidden state. Okay? So it's just a vector that gathers information so that we can have some conditional dependencies about the previous spin. Okay? And the size of this vector is a hyperparameter. So the size of h of n, which I can call, for instance, dh, is a hyperparameter. So the larger this value is, the more we expect to memorize about the previous spins, okay, or about the past. Okay. So the intuition is that as dh increase, the expressiveness will increase. Okay. And as you can tell from the formula over here, so if we just do by compatibility of dimensions, the size of this matrix should be, can someone tell me? Yeah, if you can guess. What's the expected size of W and V and B as well, just from doing the compatibility of the dimensions? Can you say it again? Yeah, so the size, so remember that the size of this is dh. The size of this is 2. The size of this is dh again. And so that's the information. So that what will be the size of w and v given information here? Yeah, so the size of this is dh squared, right? Exactly. So that will be dh by dh. What about v? Exactly, yeah. So that would be dh by 2. And what about the bias? 2. Good job, yes. Or can you check again? It's not D. It's D, yeah. Sorry about that. So it's D. So that the size of the bias is the same as the hidden state. Okay? Now, this was the first part, the RNN cell. Now let's go to the softmax layer. Okay, let me do it over here. So the output yn is a function of the new hidden state or memory state, and it's computed as follows. So first we do a softmax activation function, and then we take that our new hidden state, and then we multiply with some weight matrix U, and then we add some bias C, and then we add the two, and we apply the softmax on top of this combination. So just to remind you, I think maybe you don't see this part. Let me write the soft. What does the softmax do when it's applied on a vector? So if you apply a softmax on a two-dimensional vector, at the output, you'll get something like that. Exponential of v1 over exponential of v1 plus exponential of v2. And then here we're going to get the exponential v2 over exponential v1 plus exponential of v2. Okay, so you can see from this construction that this vector is normalized. Okay. It's a good idea to be normalized so that each of these conditionals is normalized, so that at the end, the whole joint probability is normalized. So we don't need to divide by the normalization if we use the softmax. Okay? Sounds good? Everyone? Okay. So just to recap again. So first, what we do if we want to get some new samples, we compute these conditionals sequentially, and we also generate these conditions, these spins sequentially until we get the full spin configuration. And then we can compute the probability of these spin configurations using this chain rule over here. For instance, if we want to apply this for applications in quantum physics, maybe this could be, for instance, the probability squared or the amplitude squared of some ansatz we can call psi rnn. Okay? This is what I wanted to show you after in the presentation. But just I think I don't have time to discuss the deep neural like rnn. But just what I wanted to mention is that we, instead of only having one RNN cell, we can stack them in layers. So instead of only having one RNN cell, you can have one RNN cell and then second one, third one. We can build a deep RNN, similarly to what we do in deep learning. Okay, I just wanted to comment about that very quickly. And with respect to the discussion about the exploding and the vanishing gradient problem, I think that would take a while to explain. So you can find the notes on the wiki. And what I want to spend on the last 5 minutes is just to wanted to show you some results about how RNNs perform in practice, okay, in applications to quantum many-body physics. Let me share slides.
Maybe just from your experience with working with RNNs.
Yes.
Just say what is really so amazing.
So from my experience with RNNs, yes.
It just looks like, oh, you're, you know, just looping through the same layer again and again.
Yes, yeah.
Is there anything more to it, or?
Is the question is like why it's, why?
So cool.
Oh, why it's so cool? Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. So, I wish I didn't bring it down, but like. What you mentioned here is that we keep using the same architecture again and again and again. And why this is so cool is because of that the fact that we don't need to use a lot of parameters. So if we use the weight, like the same parameters in each cell, we're going to minimize a lot of, like similarly to what we do in convolutional neural networks, we like minimize the number of parameters we use. That's the first thing. And another advantage of using this weight sharing that's also called in literature is the fact that many of physical systems have translation invariance. So by using the same parameters in each RNN cell, we kind of translate the fact that we have some translation invariance. Okay?